Welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is Joel. This movie is too serious. I don't want to do like a goofy intro for this
Listen,
one.
I didn't get any pleasure out of it watching this movie, that is. No, I'm just kidding. I did. But no, wait, that sounds wrong too. Okay, hi. How's it going?
Phrasing.
Yeah, this is the second half of Chirac pairing. We tackle in Spotlight, the Oscar winner from 2015, and joining us is Justin Harrison from
Howdy.
the. So, what made you want to pick Spotlight?
Well, aside from having good memories of seeing it in theaters, I have some journalistic training from high school and college. It's a field that I respect immensely. And in terms of depicting the procedural work of journalism, and for that matter, of law, Spotlight does a pretty fine job of what can be a fairly dry, fairly obscure practice sometimes. That's something to admire. Moreover, on a personal level, my little brother just finished up school in Boston this year, so it was kind of a hoot to go and see the city where he lived for 4 years through the le through a very different lens.
Oh.
But
I've been to Boston like 4 years ago, and it made me want to go back. Love that
yeah,
city. So
it's a
many
pretty
bookstores.
town.
They have more bookstores than New York, which is not surprising because the college town, but so many great bookstores everywhere. I spent
Yeah,
too much money there.
cheers. I had a chance to visit, I wish I could recall the name, but it was this really, really great two-level bookshop. Picked up my copy of Lou Burney's The Long and Far Away Gone there, which is a very good, I suppose personal mystery might be the best term for it. Follows two characters, both of whom are trying to process personal tragedies that occurred years in their past, and now in their adulthoods, they find themselves with an opportunity to revisit those incidents and perhaps attain some answers or some closure.
I like we'll get back to Spotlight at some point, Joel, but my the thing I'm most proud of picking up at Boston was at the oldest bookstore in America in there. It opened like in the 1830s and it's still up and running. And I bought a book on Nigerian history that's like rare and hard to find for like $96. And
Nice.
yeah, and there's because they have a rare book area of stuff that's like insanely rare. Like this is like a legit rare book. Yeah. So Joel, I understand you're a fan of Spotlight.
Well, okay, first of all, you guys are like, oh man, it just made me remember the times of Boston and stuff like that. I watch this movie and I go, I'm never going to fucking Boston. I may not be a prepubescent boy, but I still don't want anyone to touch my ding dong or something like that, and that's what I hear what they do down in Boston, at least according to this movie.
Happens everywhere. You saw the graphic.
Exactly. That's why I don't leave the house. If somebody's going to touch my ding dong, they're going to come into my place.
By that logic, if you go to Boston, you'll be brutally murdered at the on the orders of Jack Nicholson.
Something I'm also afraid of. See? Terrible place. And this
Yes, but you might
something
also run
about
into Leo DiCaprio.
at least down here Jack Nicholson's just trying to figure out why the water is being diverted,
He's a Lakers fan, so he should get murdered.
Oh man. Why? He's dying inside. As a Lakers fan, we all are. He doesn't need to
Wait,
be separately murdered.
you're a Lakers fan?
Of course I'm a Lakers fan. What's the other choice? Clippers? Hell no.
Okay, I never knew this about you. We can discuss this later.
No. I don't watch baseball. I see. I just called it baseball. I do watch baseball. I don't watch basketball. Anyways, Spike already hates me. That's enough to know.
I mean, Spike hates me for being a Celtics fan, but Lakers—that's
So,
unreasonable.
Spotlight the movie. For some reason, I'm just like magnetically drawn to this. Like I saw it in the theater with Sarah, and we both really liked it, and then it's been on Netflix. I don't know if it is currently on Netflix, but we've just
Not at the moment, no.
No, it's on Tubi
Yeah, we've just put
currently.
it on like 3 or 4 times, and it's just so interesting to watch, like the way they put the, it's kind of, they're solving a mystery in a sense, a mystery that everybody knows. It's like an open secret. Hold on, somebody's being arrested, I guess. I don't know. Okay, they just drove by. They're solving an open secret in this town, like actually putting together like the way that the church is hiding this from the general public. And it is dry. It's very much all the President's Men, where we're just seeing them do the work, do the footwork, doing the talking to the people who don't want to get talk and stuff like that. And it is played out so well by these amazing actors that, like, I guess I that's why I like it so much. But it's a heavy subject. Usually when it's a subject that, about that particular thing, it's like, well, I watched it once, I'm never going to watch it again, but I'm glad I did. Now, this one, for some reason, I just keep going back to.
I think I'm a one and done because I went to Catholic school for a long time, and
Oh, they do in English.
no, but some accused priest did go through the area where I grew up.
Sheesh. I'm sorry.
That I later learned. I remember bringing up religion class in high school, and my teacher told me, "I'm going to hell for accusing this man of pedophilia." When which all I said was, "Oh, some of the accused priests went through my parish," and then the teacher, "Oh, yeah, that's a whole nother thing." But the whole topic of the corruption within the Catholic Church is something that I don't need a movie to be aware of. But I am glad I watched it. It feels like a very classic Hollywood movie, otherwise, because it's a
It
big
does.
ensemble. It's like this very, like, it's a Hollywood model of you have all these big movie stars and they all have little bit parts, and they are, like, it feels like this, this could have been made in the 50s or like the 60s or like the 30s. It has a very classic feel to it.
Procedural is so often something of a derogatory term in terms of storytelling, because you think of the, endless CSIs and NCISs and other assemblages of acronyms that are about white guys enforcing the status quo. But where I think a director, and I believe at least co-writer, maybe full writer, Todd McCarthy excels in his filmmaking here is in diving into that process, and then through following that, making the moral horror of what has been uncovered, or in some cases, what has been realized, making that fully blossom. It's not quite as immediately terrifying as, say, watching Zodiac is, but the scale is greater. So when that impact does arrive, it hits on a deeper level, and the impact lingers. I think of the least famous member of our four-person ensemble, because we have
Oh,
Michael Keaton.
who you're talking about? Ryan Darcy James.
Yes, he may be my favorite performer of the four. Michael Keaton and oh goodness gracious
Mark
me, I just
Ruffalo.
can't. Rachel McAdams. I actually wasn't wild at Mark Ruffalo's work. I think it.
I like him a lot. He has like a golden retriever energy to him in this.
That's a fair point. I think he uses more energy than the scene necessarily calls for in places, and. Like just on a metatextual level, I'm not wild at his being cast as a Latino reporter. That's kind of.
As a Latino myself, I have to say he is our best Latino actor, so I don't see the problem.
The same way Ben Affleck was a good Latino actor.
So Joel, would you have preferred Danny Trejo in that role instead?
I prefer what about Danny Trejo in all the roles?
I'd be fine with that.
That would be interesting. I'd like to see Danny Trejo play super reserved and polite and, casually corrupt and.
Danny Trejo as Cardinal Law, who's being watched by the Danny Trejo as Michael Keaton.
To my point originally, the sequence where Brian Dassey James's Dassey James playing reporter Matt Carroll realizes that one of the places where the church has been stuffing priests who got caught molesting children is less than 2 blocks away from his home and his kids. And well, that is supremely disturbing filmmaking. And James's work isn't, oh my God, this horrible thing. I must scream and rend my clothing and rub mud into my hair. It's just like, oh, that's the scale of this. There are predators within walking distance of my children.
Yeah, he puts a note on the fridge.
Yeah, and the fact that you can't exactly just explain, hey kids, there's a whole bunch of child rapists living a few doors down from us. Don't go there.
Right, yeah, because he's got the sense to know that if he tells, even if he probably tells his immediate family the situation there, that could probably start a witch hunt situation within the neighborhood. And it's like, he doesn't, that's the thing, they're all waiting for this like moment to be, for all the evidence that they have to be collected for the right thing. So yeah, no, I like, he plays a father like a father would, but and nobody really has any explosions in this movie. I think the only time
Like
is,
Ruffalo's got that big speech.
yeah, that time when he gets pissed off that they're not gonna follow through until, I mean, he wants to get it out there, yeah. But he's like, one of the things I like about his character is that he, there's stuff going on in his life that we don't get into, like they indicate, like he seems to be separated from his wife or something like that. And we don't really get the details, but there is something like he needs to be working on this. Like he needs to have something to focus on. And that part where
Like
he's just so happy to have that pizza.
he's explicitly a workaholic, so
Right.
much so that even before they pick up the story, he is jonesing to have something to do, whether that's due to the potential end of his marriage or the cause of the potential end of his marriage isn't really explored. But McCarthy and the cast give us enough sense of these folks' lives beyond this story that they feel like real people, even though the vast majority of the film is dedicated not necessarily to them, but to what they're doing.
Yeah, you have some journalistic training. So are like, do you know about the real people that the movie's based off of?
I read some of their responses to the film back when it came out. I don't know of them personally, but just having worked on a high school paper, having studied journalism in college and to a lesser extent in graduate school, it's neat to see the process taken so seriously and not being reduced to this series of eureka, stop the presses, everything is super dramatic moments. It's bit by bit, piece by piece. When you catch a break, it's a matter of shifting perspective more than coming to a realization that puts everything together. Like, for instance, when they realize that they can use their Catholic directories not to confirm priests, but to actively seek out potentially predatory priests based on the pattern of identifications they have discovered in those texts.
Yeah,
That,
it.
and I think it was the folks on the Next Picture Show podcast who pointed out that this is also a rather interesting period piece. And obviously, 9/11 plays a large part in the back half, in the fallout of the back half of the story, as does the fact that these stories hit during a very specific year. But more in the background, we've got the beginning of the major decline for newspapers as the internet grew in influence and power. You're starting to see potential layoffs. You're starting to see local journalistic power being concentrated at bigger, more prominent papers that can weather rough times better than local papers. It's one of the things that Ruffalo and Stanley Tucci bring up in one of their first conversations that. It's one thing to have a story. It's another thing to have a story in a paper that people actually read.
Yeah,
And
and they bring up like you're saying like about the scope of the papers, and they thought the New York Times was either by the Boston Globe or was about to buy Boston Globe, and so there's the whole like, corporate angle that's kind of got brought up. That does play into how they approach the investigation too.
And it's worth noting that, again, this is paraphrasing from an X Picture show. To all your listeners out there, if you have not listened to the Next Picture Show, it is the folks who were once the Dissolve examining a new movie in the context of an older movie. It's a lot of fun. But one of the things that they caught is that, the parking lot has at the Globe has noticeably empty spaces. It's not a desert or anything, but they are starting to lose staff in the same way that many papers, even really big, powerful ones, would throughout the next 20 some odd years. Hell, the Times keeps getting in trouble because they don't have a public editor.
So, Jordan, do you remember when this story was breaking? Because you would have been early 20s around that time. So, like, were you aware of the scandal that the Boston Globe uncovered?
I mean, just in aware of the same sense of any large news story was. I'm not Catholic. I've never been really around any sort of Catholic thing, and it was always. That's the thing. It's like always been presumed that that was like going on. Like there were always, occasional scandals where things were happening, but such a big, sweeping thing that was supposed to reform the church, and who knows what actually happened. The Pope's coming out and actually saying like, "Oh no, this isn't good." Like, yeah, no shit. I don't know. I
In
see.
other news, scientists determined the Titanic to be wet.
Yes.
I kind of remember this becoming a thing because it was kind of talked about in hushed tones around the school I went to. I went to Catholic school from kindergarten to ninth grade, so I was aware of like, okay, something bad is happening that I'm not supposed to know about because I would have been 10 at the time. Did they publish a story in 2001 or 2002?
They published in early 2002, the initial one, I believe.
Yeah, so I would have been 10, turning 11 that year. So I do remember like kind of hushed tones of the abuse, and then in middle school, they couldn't really hide it from everyone, and so it was like a weird thing to bring up in school with like the and stuff, and like it was just like so I have a very vivid memory of like the story breaking, and I don't want to get too personal here, so I'll kind of stop there. So like this movie to me was a little a strange thing to experience from this like that from just like the perspective of being a child in Catholic school when this was happening, and I'm not
Yeah.
sure if you can really relate to that exactly, but like as a some of this was like I like the beginning in particular is like yeah I don't like with like they arrest the priest for with the child, and it's like they talk about you can't arrest a priest, and it's like oh, I remember thinking like okay I don't think I will ever watch this movie again. It's a little too much.
Too close.
Yeah.
I see.
And there are definitely, this did not affect me directly because I was raised Unitarian Universalist. We got our own share of issues, but we're like the weird little hippie Christians. I remember seeing headlines about it in my local Pennsylvania paper, and I think I remember my parents talking about it in some capacity, if only because of the sheer scale of it. It was something that I, Joel, like you, it was like something I was aware was happening, but didn't quite realize the scale or the depth of it. And Spencer, that it's always interesting to see a film that where something unexpectedly connected to you takes you off guard, or you're in this case expected. But even in something as relatively silly as like the Ben Affleck movie The Accountant, there is a diabetic character in that was just like, oh wow, that's it's a little weird to have to have a character dying of complications from diabetes, and not just in the background. Like that's very explicitly the it's a very explicit part of this big silly conspiracy, and it was just like, oh wow, that's not super comfortable for me to witness. Or just on a note for a film perhaps more comparable to Spotlight, at the end of Selma, when we're getting the text follow-ups on what happened to the historical figures, and amongst MLK's allies is a white woman who was murdered shortly after the film, the events of the film. She herself was a Unitarian Universalist. And that was downright surreal for me, because my experience of Unitarian Universalism has mostly been this one intensely dysfunctional church that more or less killed any faith I had for a very, very long time. And so here's someone for whom religion was not only a powerful positive force in her life, but it motivated her to step up and do the work of being good, of challenging vast systemic injustice in a way that I kind of doubt anyone in power in my church, prior to my mom basically pulling the entire thing out of the trash by herself, would have.
Like when I learned what this movie was when it was coming out, I actually decided then I can skip this one. I don't need to see it.
Yeah,
But I
no
am
doubt.
glad I did watch it. It was, you know, like the hypocrisy. We can skip around. Like the hypocrisy of like the Catholic school that bookie character went to, of like, well, donors, like other like the rich donors who were kind of like, can't happen, but where it just ignores like, oh, I've met those kinds of people, and God, it was just like that whole sequence with the school donor and stuff was the most infuriating, because like that's like the part pop possibly like the most insidious part of sorry, but like the most insidious part of like the whole scope of everything. Like even the people who, you know, like keep the school alive are fully aware of what's happening, and they are choosing to just ignore it.
Yeah, it's assumed to be so big that nothing can be done until you step up and actually do something. In the process, you have to realize that you yourself, if you are were in a position to do something about it and did not, for whatever reason, that you bear your share of responsibility. That's one of the things that makes the penultimate scene hit so hard, is Keaton realizing that, hey, we had information to do something about this years ago. I am directly responsible for it not happening.
Yeah.
It's, when you make something seem inevitable, it's very easy to accept it as such, to take it as a given, be it in church, be it in government, be it in your own personal life. One other little detail I enjoyed from the ending was, again, James' character like taking up horror writing just as a light distraction from everything.
Oh yeah, that's a nice little joke, which I didn't realize the irony in that until just now. I do wonder if that was a quick. I did look into the real people a little bit, but I didn't see if Matt Carroll did had a book published or not.
I remember back when the film came out, like the folks who were on the Spotlight team at the time did get together for a retrospective, and they did like present the archive of their completed work on the story again. Like that, usually whenever a major newspaper story gets adapted, that tends to happen. Like back when Michael Bay's Pain and Gain came out, the paper
Oh,
he adapted, like they reran that entire series.
yeah.
Because nothing says sober examination of systemic abuse like Michael Bay.
Yeah, and at least he's trying something different, and then he immediately went back to his old shit.
From what I understand, he basically held the fourth Transformers movie hostage to get Pain and Gain made.
A little bit. So what do you guys think of Rachel McAdams? Because she's basically like the only woman movie also, which I think is definitely notable.
She is. Like so much of the cast, she is consistently very good. Now, this is This is by design a fairly sedate picture. You're not going to have any of the grand acting moments like Michael Keaton had for, say, Birdman, whose director was unexpectedly lost out to this for Best Picture with The Revenant. It's like even much as I don't particularly, I don't think that Mark Ruffalo is great in this film. Even his big fiery speech is almost immediately diffused, and he concedes the point that, okay, much as I may want to get this terrifying and vital information out, we need to do more work to make it more effective. This is a buckle down movie, and not in a bad way.
Or Mark Ruffalo has like the dog energy of like being like the hyper like upbeat one, like just wants to work. Like Mitchell Adams seems to be more like a long line of like example, but like how people say like Anne Hathaway has like the energy of like she's like a A plus student who's trying really hard, where like Rachel Adams kind of has that vibe of like just trying to be a journalist taken seriously to an extent, because
Yep.
like she's kind of the only woman in who's there, I think, who has a significant role really, besides
That's like
maybe
we,
yeah,
that's never
we
brought up that she's a woman though. It's like it's not really a part
yeah.
of the movie. I mean, she's doing the work just like everybody else does. She has some real that whole part where she goes and knocks on the door of the guy and he basically confesses to her like right away. And she continues to like try to question him as it's going on. It's she doesn't blink when this stuff is happening. I mean, she's taken him out for a second, but she, continues to try to get that information out of her. I don't feel like she was trying to put any. It didn't feel like she was trying to prove herself to me in this movie. It felt like it was just
Well, kind of
her
feel
doing the
like,
work.
yeah, I see what you're saying, but it's also just like it just sticks out like the only female character in the whole movie who actually you consistently see is her, and she's surrounded by all these men.
I feel like that's probably pretty normal for like the I mean the spotlight group is a specialty group, when it comes to the amount of women to men in job situations. I don't feel like that's that weird, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was surprised Liev Schreiber was not in it more.
Well,
He has like maybe like four scenes, maybe five.
I love him
Like,
in this
not
movie.
that.
He is wonderful, and I wouldn't object to spending more time with him. He's actually the editor of my the man he's playing is actually the editor of my paper of choice right now, the Washington Post. But
Oh.
he's it's worth remembering that, as important as the spotlight story is to him and as involved as he is, he's also got to edit the rest of the paper. So he's got plenty of stuff going on in the background.
Yeah, it's true. Cause like, I like the detail of him being Jewish. Well, I think they drew. I watched it a week ago.
No, yeah, he definitely is,
Yeah,
which is hilarious when Cardinal Law, hands him that.
The book on catechism,
Yeah,
and it's
he
like,
is
oh, I
Jewish,
see.
he is unmarried, and he doesn't like baseball, and he's editing a paper in Boston.
Yeah, we're not supposed to. I mean, I think we're not supposed to know what side he's on in the beginning, because I mean, when he gets brought in, he's essentially there to figure out who needs to be kept on and who doesn't, anyways, as part of his new position. So when it turns out he does want them to continue to pursue the story, I think it's a good surprise. But I just love how unemotional he is, and he's got this kind of like sardonic sense of humor when he's talking to Robbie in the movie, but otherwise it's like he strikes me as a person who's never had to raise his voice ever.
I mean,
He
if you,
says
yeah,
precisely what he means to say when he means to say it.
it's always in the back of his throat. So, if you're not close enough to hear him, that's your fault.
I mean, he exudes, like it's cliche to say about Higa, because it was like power and like control, and it's like, like you see him in a room, it's like, oh, I guess he's in charge.
And then he's fra and I also quite like how he's framed as a constant presence in the main newsroom, even though he's off in his office. And it's like brought up that he is constantly there, constantly working, much to the consternation of folks who would l make a point of leaving only after the editor has left. Like the last time we see him in the film, he's back at work in that corner office. No, not even fully in focus. He's just doing the job.
Yeah, and see, I guess we should talk about Michael Keaton a bit, because he seems to have the real, I guess he and Rachel McAdams have the real emotional arcs in this movie.
Yep.
And
I mean,
Michael Keaton, yeah, he kind of, his arc kind of involved, like, you were saying, like, the guy he plays, Robbie Robinson, was the editor in the 90s when they have broken the story.
it is as much about accepting responsibility for his shit, for his complicity in the ongoing conspiracy, even at a remove from the folks directly conspiring to keep predatory priests in circulation and away from accountability, as it is his holding those people accountable now. And he it's it's definitely closer to, say, Michael Keaton playing a goofy dad in Spider-Man than it is Michael Keaton playing a pretentious actor in Birdman.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, there were a few times where his costuming in this film made me like, okay, so he's gonna go get that vulture suit and terrorize someone, isn't he? But
And that's exactly what he did afterwards.
And like the whole connector of him with going to the school literally across the street, that's just, that played into, and I think there was like,
well, I mean, his wife knew him and was happy to see him the time he came over to the house and stuff like that. I got the feeling that they did, had like dinners together or stuff like that, and things like that. And not the same as like Billy Crudup's character, who's just like, we've dealt with you before because you're a lawyer, so we have a casual business friendliness kind of thing. Like this other guy, it was like he had decided that the getting this information for his story was more important than maintaining the small level of friendship he had with the guy, which I totally understand. I don't know if I would want to be friends with a person that I knew was sitting on all this secret information anyways. Spencer, tell me your secrets.
None.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, some of this, like some of this movie just like hit too hard. Like the Rachel McAdams stuff, I related to a little too much without getting personal in that whole arc. Because like, that's, I wish it was like that in real life, but it's not. Well, you ever see the resolution of after her grandma sees it? So that's kind of up in the air,
I mean,
which I assumed her grandma was continued going to church and all that, based because she's an older woman, and like if you're that old and still going to church all the time, it's like, well, you're not gonna stop necessarily. It's kind of that's not how it works.
but now she knows, not remotely on the same level of as the children who are preyed upon, but in concealing that level of abuse, the church higher ups betrayed and did harm to their parishioners in the process. Here is an organization that you put considerable trust in to be a guiding force for good in your life. Here is an organization that you may have devoted a significant amount of time and money to, and it turns out that on some level you were being used as a shiny object to keep people from looking too closely because of all the good that you were doing at the time. Like that would be hard to learn for anyone, never mind someone who had been, as you said, in the church for decades.
in like I think it was at some like fundraiser thing that Keaton's character goes to, like, they keep emphasizing they do so much good for the community, which is like, okay, this is mafia shit. Like, the mafia, it did help after 9/11 and after natural disasters. That is true, but still the mafia.
I've been thinking about that myself a lot lately. Turns out that the guy who Goodfellas is based on wrote a cookbook. And it's
Steve Martin.
either he or his ghostwriter is a very friendly, warm presence who is sincerely devoted to good food. It's like, this man was involved in organized crime for literal decades. Like, this is not a good person. This is perhaps a charming person, perhaps a likable person, and as a document of a very specific piece of culture tied to cooking, this is fascinating, and the recipes look good, but it's still like, dude, you were literally a murderous mobster.
And you're talking about what Spencer and I have discussed, and you may cut this part out, but I don't know, of the Mike Tyson conundrum.
Yeah,
speaking of Todd Phillips,
exactly. I was just gonna say that.
I like the, I guess, like, it's an ensemble movie, so I guess there are no, like, real central characters besides, like, the four, and then you have, like, a couple scenes of, like, all these other side people, and as always, Stanley Tucci is the best.
I have never seen him do poor work, you know. Coming back around to on my end, Michael Bay, he is legitimately fantastic as Merlin the Drunk Con Man in that last Transformers movie.
Let's see here. I'm looking for his poor
Tucci always
work.
knows. Tucci always knows exactly the movie he's in.
Plays the material and not in a way that suggest and not in a way that he's only as good as what he's given, but he knows how to make whatever he's doing work, no matter the situation.
That I like that his character was they're saying character because these are almost entirely real people. I think they're all real people, but like the way he's playing it was, he's this he's an asshole lawyer who knows he's right and just happens to be right.
And it's worth noting that, like, his last scene in the movie, it's, you know, he's immediately super gentle and kind with these kids who he's going to represent. Like that is, it is so far removed from his behavior throughout the rest of the film that it's just like, wow.
You know,
Because I think,
I think it's
no.
with along with all the rest of these characters, it's not that he's mean, it's just that he is too busy. He is too busy for anything else. He's too busy for any bullshit that somebody might be trying to interrupt you because he's got real work that he has to do and all this stuff like that. But I mean, that scene where he just wants to eat his damn lunch because, you know, he's got a 30-second, yeah, not 30-second, a 30-minute window where he can eat his lunch on this park bench and not be bothered by it. And it's just like,
And he is almost certainly going to take some of that lunch back to the office to finish.
exactly, yeah. Papers everywhere, just like back in the newspaper office, you know, stacks of piles of papers that they're working on and things like that.
Hell, the first time we meet Mark Ruffalo, speaking of which, you know, Rachel McAdams is bringing him cake because he couldn't get up and go to the thing himself.
Yeah, and like bringing him cake thing also may seem have a dog energy, like, oh, here's a treat for doing your work a little too.
He's all hunched over like a dog. You got this pretty much down right there, yeah.
Yeah,
You do realize that we have now
he's
cursed him to appear in some really shitty animated film, like,
I'm sure he has already.
I mean, like, one thing I learned about the existence of recently, speaking of Avengers actors, is that Jeremy Renner is, for some reason, probably money, starring in this utterly inexplicable looking animated film called Arctic Dogs that my boss took one look at and was like, yeah, that's a tax dodge.
Oh, I saw
Needs to pay for his new studio
and or his, you know,
and his
ongoing
act failed
divorce
too.
and abuse issues.
I saw a pop-up thing at the theater for Arctic Dogs, and the first thing
Oh,
that
man.
popped out to me, this is proving how strange I am, was Omar Sy.
I mean, I saw that. Well, it's like every year we get at least one of these borderline no budget animated films that follow a cookie cutter plot and have these utterly bizarre assemblage of talent. Like,
it's like I saw like Jeremy Renner and Omar Sy in the same movie. That's crazy.
And they're
Omar Sy
playing
was
shitty
Bishop.
animated dogs.
Yeah, Omar Sy was Bishop in whatever movie came out recently. And he was in a movie I love, Mood Indigo, the Michelle Gondry movie. But who else was there? Besides that, like the rest of the cast, I didn't really recognize besides Tucci. And I think that helped add to the realism of everything.
And like you have Billy Crudup for about a minute and a half, but it's like, oh, hey, it's Billy Crudup. Oh, bye, Billy Crudup.
You know, something just occurred to me. John Slattery. Slattery. He basically plays. He doesn't have other notes. I'm not to say I don't like him. I do really like John Slattery, but he doesn't. He basically plays himself. He seems to have been stuck in a time warp, because you know, Mad Men. The past, this one, the past. And then I was thinking, oh, what about those Avengers movies? Oh, wait. No, he's been in the past in those two. Guys, we need to free John Slattery.
Is he unstuck in time?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Is he...
That or he's been, like, secretly traveling through time, correcting nexus points to keep it from collapsing on itself.
There you go.
Yeah, it's like those photos of Keanu Reeves in the 1800s.
Does that mean he's on a spaceship on an alien zoo with a porn star?
He might just be a brain in a jar that, you know, his consciousness is being moved.
Does he have
he's going to be assassinated years from now by someone contracted by a jerky new during World War II.
I'm not making a fat joke. I'm making a reference to Slaughterhouse 5. I just want to make that clear.
Yep. Yeah, I mean,
John Slattery, I watched the first season of Mad Men before stopping, but it seems like he's kind of playing the same thing.
Right. I mean, in Mad Men, he's kind of a cocky asshole. In this one, he's a team player with the rest of them. Like, he's kind of just a side character along with Liev Schreiber, almost, where, you know, it's, they must have an important role, but they're not the investigators on this particular story.
Yeah, like they have other responsibilities in the paper, and we intersect with them as they intersect with the Spotlight team. Mm-hmm. Also, fun bit of historical trivia, Ben Bradley Jr., son of Ben Bradley Sr., editor behind Woodward and Bernstein breaking Watergate.
Oh, wow. Let's see what Ben Bradley III is going to do.
Yeah, he's going to have to figure something out.
Yeah, he'll build a Gundam.
Joel.
He'll edit an expose on the Gundam.
I noticed that there are multiple Marvel movie actors who are in this movie.
Yes.
And it's almost like 25th Hour, which 25th Hour had three people from X2 and it had two MCU people. And this movie has Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Leo Schreiber,
Rachel McAdams.
Was she in one?
She's in Doctor Strange.
Yeah, she's in Doctor Strange. Stanley Tucci, who's in the first Captain America.
Oh, yeah.
And over at the Distinguished Competition, you've got Billy Crudup as Dr. Manhattan, this time wearing clothing.
Yeah, and the superhero movies get everyone.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, he's in.
You know, that's hard. Oh yeah, he is. And that's part of what Birdman was whining about. But
I'm not being a Martin Scorsese. I'm just saying, like everyone has shown up in Marvel or DC.
There's no reason.
It's
Martin Scorsese. He's entitled to his opinion. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an old man. What would you expect from an old man?
He's not wrong. He's not really a jerk about it. Coppola's kind of a putz.
Yeah,
but
he's
a putz for a
so.
Number of reasons.
Yeah.
Read interviews from like the 70s when he's talking about not getting movies made. Like even back then, he's an asshole.
Yeah. But, Scorsese, meanwhile, seems to be a fairly together dude these days.
Yeah, he's
But
still doing stuff, you know. Like, what is? I mean, once Coppola stopped having offsprings and heirs, like no one cares anymore. Come on.
yeah, like one of the best. Unfortunately, it's been presumably closed for quite some time now. But one of the best experiences I ever had as a film dweeb was visiting the Museum of the Moving Image in New York when they had the first ever exhibit on Martin Scorsese. He gave them access to a huge number of his personal documents. So did De Niro, so did Paul Schrader. Hilariously, De Niro and Schrader's private collections are both kept at UT Austin. So I was seeing stuff there that I had seen in boxes over at UT, which was kind of wild. But they had, an entire room dedicated to the way that he and Thelma Schoonmaker would edit films, complete with a little, edit your own Martin Scorsese scene interactive booth. They had this storyboard for a sword and sandal epic that Martin Scorsese, age 10, had drawn on this giant sheet of paper. It was so cool. It was so cool.
Yeah, turns out he's been a dork his whole life.
Oh, he had no choice to be a dork. He was a lonely little asthmatic kid with
Oh yeah,
who
that's
was
true.
short, like the third who is short.
Yeah.
He's not exactly gonna go around tormenting people and being an ur-jock.
He does have good taste in movies.
And the whole cinema preservation thing is pretty cool.
Yeah, like he's integral to having like Tookie Bookie former episode, yeah, having that get preserved.
Point of this is Martin Scorsese is a cool dude. Marvel fans, take a breath, go for a walk, eat a mint.
Yeah, and also watch King Comedy and then watch Hugo. He's does more gangster movies.
Oh yeah. Oh God, Joker is, I think someone described it as like King Comedy cosplay. It is bad cosplay. That's like, it's not quite at cardboard box Gundam level,
So
but what
one of my favorite reviewers, Tasha Robinson, gave it 4.5 stars. So
I'll have to read her review on it then.
I see so many different takes on it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's good or bad, or I feel like with Spotlight we've talked around it enough. It's a powerful movie. Like
It's a
the
darn fine film,
Would you say
a
it's
worthy
good,
winner for Best Picture.
Spencer?
I would say it's very good. I just never want to watch it again.
That's
I'd
fair.
watch *12 Years a Slave* again because I've read the book now. I want to see how it compares. And the book is really good, but there's some weird history behind the writing of it that's questionable. But yeah, you can get into that's a discussion for another day. But yeah, I am glad I watched it at the end when I get all the phone calls. That just like that hit me really hard, and it's like, oh, you're gonna end on that note. And it's like that's like this perfect ending, and it's uplifting and depressing at the same time. And it's like that, like I don't know if Tom McCarthy has done anything
He's got
since
a
this,
movie for
but
Disney Plus coming out, and apparently he like directed 2 episodes of 13 episodes of not 13 thir that of that 13 Reasons Why thing, which people
oh.
either really like or really hate. I can't speak to it.
We didn't even mention that he was kind of primed for this kind of work, having been on that fifth season of The Wire, which is basically all about newspaper type thing. He's kind of whatever that glass guy's name is, making up the story type thing to spoil that entire season. You should watch The Wire, by the way.
I have one season left, and I haven't come to season five yet.
Oh, sorry.
It's fine. I knew about how Omar died before. Not Omar, Stringer Bell died before I saw it. It's fine.
Five has plenty of good moments. It's certainly one of the weaker parts of that series overall.
My favorite season is the Greek mobsters.
That's season two.
Yeah,
Yeah.
season two.
It's hard to go wrong with Pablo Schreiber. He is, speaking of leave,
No, my favorite season is the school. No, it's
yeah,
all
four.
good.
Season four.
Season four.
Yeah.
I think two and
Yeah.
four are my favorites.
Like, speaking of work by talented people, at some point I will watch The Deuce, maybe when James Franco gets eaten by velociraptors. He's not a bad actor, but the projects that he has chosen for the past few years are less an opportunity to do interesting acting and more an opportunity to be James Franco, actor. Which I got no time for that. I got no time for that.
I'd rather hang out with Dave than James.
Dave, you know, like seems to be a fairly
Normal
decent
and
human
decent.
being and not prone to wearing hideous mustaches and
He seems fun to be around as a person.
I'd like to hang out with
yeah.
Dave and his wife.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I
Also,
want to mention.
I will forever resent Franco for like of all the people to make the disaster artist, you.
I have complex opinions on that movie, but
It makes sense. I mean, you're taking that Tommy Wiseau and you're making whatever the hell he made. I mean, come on, yeah.
But I want to talk about the other Best Picture nominations from this year.
Oh, what were they?
It's For Spies, the dad movie written by the Coen
Wait,
brothers.
what?
It's
Spielberg, the like the one
Spielberg's.
Spielberg that hasn't been scored by John Williams.
It looks like a dad
Oh,
movie.
Bridge of
Like, it's.
It's a pretty good film. I caught it in theaters.
I heard that, but like, the trailer's like, I'd rather watch it with my dad and on a Sunday at 4 in the afternoon in the theater.
Does Tom Hanks ever say in the movie, "What we have here is a bridge of spies"?
Nope.
Okay, well then I'm not watching it.
I mean, it is where Mark Rylance got his theatrical breakout, which is pretty cool. And he is, I'd say what makes that movie go from dad movie to darn good movie is the entire last act, wherein we go to Berlin and Hanks attempts to facilitate the handover of Mark Rylance for the B-2 spy plane pilot. It brings the complex. It's not quite a friendship that he and Rylance have. He is dedicated to representing this client of his to the best of his ability, and there is a deep and abiding mutual respect for each other, even though they are politically enemies. They work together very, very well, and he has to watch people get gunned down as they try to make the jump to the Allied-controlled portion of the city and can do nothing about it. And at the very end of the picture, as he's riding the subway to work, he sees some innocent kids happily running over fences in much the same way that he saw those people get gunned down. And his expression just darkens as we see him like I saw people this age doing something like this, and now they no longer exist. They will never get a chance to be alive. It's a film I think very highly of.
Okay, I will check it out at some point then. It just looks
As you
like
can tell by my interrupting you and going on a 15-minute rant, I'm sorry.
it's fine. Mad Max Fury Road, which we can bring it up later. Hint, hint about
Wrote my
coming up
thesis on
later.
it.
The Revenant, which I think is fine, but kind of not that interesting overall. At least to me, it was a little too like trying too hard to be like a brutal movie, so
Yeah,
I
it's
get it.
like, you know, if I wanted to watch a badass action movie, I'd watch a badass action movie, not a movie that believes itself to be more than a badass action movie while simultaneously leaning into the language of the badass action movie.
It is trying a little too hard, but whatever. Some people like it. I don't know. The Big
And
Short? Yeah.
I will say that I find it kind of. Do y'all remember that brief, deeply uncomfortable moment when some joker somewhere claimed, like, the bear sexually assaults Leo? And, you know, I'm pretty sure got like, that DiCaprio himself and Gonzalez Iñárritu had to, like, no, the bear just mauls him. There is no sexual assault involved. I find it interesting that it happened given the apparently staggering number of works where bears are figures of eroticism. And not like bear as in member of a certain gay subculture, but bear as in four-legged mammal.
There's fan fiction for everyone.
There's an acclaimed Canadian novel about a woman who wants to have sex with a bear. Like, this is.
There's fan fiction for everyone. Everyone has a king.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay, let's see. Reverend The Big Short, The Martian, Room, and Brooklyn, and of course, Spotlight. But of all those movies, personally, I would put Fury Road because it's a perfect mix of action and other stuff. And I can get into more later and recommend stuff. I think
Fear
we
Road's a
all,
once in a lifetime movie.
yeah. Joel, do you have any strong feelings about any of the other,
I've seen four of those, so I think I would stick with Spotlight. I mean, I love Mad Max Fury Road, but I have my problems with it. I think The Martian's really solid, but not compared. I mean, Spotlight's a better movie. And then I think Room is pretty freaking amazing. Like, if Room had won over Spotlight, I wouldn't have thought that was incorrect.
Yeah, I the 20, it's a pretty strong Best Picture slate, all things considered. I'm pretty sure I've seen all of them, and I can at least respect the technical acumen of The Revenant, even if I find it to be like a whole bunch of empty nonsense ultimately. Brooklyn is a really, 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 really fine coming of age story, and oh, the costuming is beautiful. Plus,
Yeah,
it has one of my
Saoirse Ronan is amazing in that, but
yeah.
she never phones it in.
No, and it's like super interesting to me that her collaborations with Greta Gerwig have her playing, relatively women, young women on the cusp of adulthood, right after she makes a movie about a young woman who is explicitly already in adulthood and who is figuring that out. And it's like not necessarily a step back, but it's certainly not necessarily not the direction that I thought she might have gone after seeing Brooklyn.
Yeah. And let's see, Brooklyn Bad Room. I never Big Short, the Brian heard what's about.
Oh, I
I was
forgot
like,
about that.
nope. I was like, I'm not interested in watching about the bubble or whatever the fuck it's about.
I mean,
Then
that's
I
a
heard
great
it's
movie as a like an educational piece.
I enjoyed it at the time. I'm not sure how well it would hold up to me now, especially like in the context of like Vice, where similar stylistic ticks were used to lesser results.
I like Vice. I know I'm in the minority. And I like, yeah, just like you, I liked The Big Short at the time. But I think the, like I said, I think telling us what the hell's going on and currently is still going on is probably the most important thing. Like, I can't really think of any performances that stand out in that. You got Margot Robbie doing a thing where she's not even a character in the movie. I think she's in a bathtub for some reason.
Yeah,
Hooray!
she breaks the fourth wall to explain an aspect of the stock exchange, and all the while she is in a bubble bath sipping champagne.
See, it was just based on her real life, because that's what,
Yeah.
obviously, that's what she does all the time.
Yeah. And The Martian I skipped because fake movies stress me out.
This one would definitely stress you, but it's great.
Yeah,
It's really good.
I believe you. Just, like the trailer to Interstellar, I couldn't handle on TV. I don't fuck with space. Star Wars I can handle because it never gets real. It's
Right.
all fantasy nonsense. But like
So
when you get
no
to the
gravity
Martian,
either.
oh no, that's my ultimate fear.
So you really don't want to be sent into outer space. All right.
No, not at
You're
all.
on the wrong podcast.
Fortunately, Mr. Kennedy is dead.
Never seen Apollo 13. It sounds way too stressful for me. I don't think I'd enjoy seeing through it.
What about Event Horizon?
I heard it's stupid, so
What?
maybe.
You know who said that? They're stupid.
Ooh. Okay. Well, there's a room full of spikes. Why is there a room full of spikes?
Because
It's fun. It's stupid.
On the plus side, you do have Sam Neill playing absolutely bug nuts.
Yeah, and that's always great. The problem with
As
the
is
room
opposed
full
by
of
Lawrence.
spikes. So also at this Oscars, Spike won an honorary award, which I
Yeah.
guess was maybe the "We're sorry about Do Your Thing" and Malcolm X award.
Yep.
And Chirac wasn't even nominated.
I'm okay with that.
Bullshit.
Maybe for writing because it's ambitious, but beyond that, I don't know, Wesley for supporting because Wesley's great in that.
Exactly. Bam.
And connection between those two, I I can't really think of much besides like the social issue aspect
Yeah,
of
I
it.
think that's the main issue. The main connection between the two is they're both dealing with something that is an actual, you know, they deal with the statistics and realities in the world we are living in. Are living
Yeah,
in currently,
one,
so.
it's a bit
Both
more
feature an
fun.
acclaimed, both feature a white male actor who was acclaimed in the 80s and who had a fallow period in the 90s before, well, Keaton recovered. John Cusack is still off John Cusacking.
Speaking of paying for taxes. Yeah, and
Yeah.
I mean, that, see, comparing it to Chirac, there is one issue with Spotlight, and that is no dance numbers.
Yeah, we don't have any rap concerts.
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
kind of lame.
it's 2001 in Boston, so he could have had Aesop Rock because he lived up in that area. You know, him and Blockhead could have done a concert. None of you guys know what I'm talking about. I'll stop.
I mean, I know who Aesop Rock is. I like his soundtrack for Bushwick, but that's about all I know about him.
He's a great rapper. It works Ed works with the producer Blockhead a lot. And the early stuff is really interesting, and then I don't think they work together anymore. But
Where was Johnny Depp in Spotlight? I mean, he bought those contact lenses and everything.
He was off draining someone's blood.
Yeah.
Like, I black. I've seen Black Mass. Johnny Depp is not playing Whitey Bulger. He is playing Satan and/or Count Orlok.
Oh yeah.
It's not necessarily a bad performance, but it's very, I'm Johnny Depp and I'm very evil. To the point that he's like wearing that goddamn long black duster. All he needs to do is hunch over and make claw hands, and he's a vampire.
It's a real monster, and also the character he plays.
I think the murderous mobster might come off as a better person than. It's sort of like when Klaus Kinski played Count Dracula, the murderous vampire was far and away the better human being.
On that note, I can watch Klaus Kinski because he's dead.
True, true.
And if you want to know about his personal life, look into it. He was truly a monster.
Yep. There is a world where Herzog did in fact go through with firebombing his house, and I'm okay with that.
Anyway, so there are other 2015 movies that came out that year. I think we all picked Mad Max Fury Road for one of them.
Never heard of it.
Yep.
So,
Oh,
guess we can all say here.
did you come from the universe where Fury Road was filmed in 2001 with Gibson?
Yeah, after that, Australia was destroyed, so it seemed really inappropriate to try to make another movie about it.
So, like, in this parallel universe, Bin Laden destroys Australia. Got it.
Exactly.
Interesting choice on his part.
And George Bush was the other pilot. It's really weird.
So, instead of, I'm going right to hell for this. So, in this universe, George W. Bush and Bin Laden form a terrorist organization together and destroy Australia.
Yeah, I'm taking notes right here. This is going to be a good screenplay.
I think so, yeah.
Yes. Justin, I believe you're a bit of a super fan of Fury Road, from what I've gathered.
I quite literally wrote my master's thesis because of Fury Road. Perhaps it was just that it was so striking and so expertly crafted that even in the midst of what turned out to be a severe case of diabetic ketoacidosis, wherein your blood becomes acidic. This was it, Fury Road came out just like days before I was hospitalized for what turned out to be my undiagnosed type 1 diabetes. And even in the midst of the then mysterious, awful feeling and constant blurriness, it was electric. To have the myth that George Miller has always talked about, the notion that the wasteland is a place where this where Mad Max isn't necessarily a specific person, but a figure who originated from a specific person. In this case, Max Rockatansky gradually becomes more and more mythical to the point that by Beyond Thunderdome, he takes on messianic connotations. I mean, admittedly, some of that is whatever the fuck Gibson's got going on in his screwed up head, but to have the role successfully change over from Gibson to Hardy, who plays the part very, very differently while still carrying the same trauma that Gibson brought to the role, and while still probably being the same person, given that it's the first time since the original Mad Max that he is credited specifically as Max Rockatansky. It's a really, really impressive piece of direction on Miller's part, all the more so since Hardy was apparently kind of a pill to work with. You have Charlize Theron building on the warrior heroine archetype we've been seeing as far back as Mad Max 2, and that which was then complicated by Tina Turner in Beyond Thunderdome, with a character who is seeking salvation and regeneration through violence so that the women who come after her, the women in her care, will not have to pursue the same path. And that during the action scenes, she is never less than badass, even when she's visibly like, oh shit, I can't believe this is happening. Like during that awesome chase when the war rig is fleeing from the rock riding motorcyclists, there's a bit where one of the riders, she shoots a rider off his motorcycle and it comes within a nanometer of hitting her, and Theron has just like great oh fuck face, and then she gets right back up and goes on with the fight. It's tremendous work from her. Hugh Keay's Byrne, to bring him back from the first Mad Max to play a villain so far removed from Toe Cutter. Forgive me, I could rant. I could go. I adore this film. I wrote my goddamn thesis because of this film.
Toker, Hugh, he has a crappy name, I always forget it. He was in the movie, the great Hong Kong Australian production, The Man from Hong Kong, playing a side character. And even though he's doesn't have crazy makeup and all that, like, you immediately recognize him because those piercing eyes.
It's super
He
striking.
he's insanely recognizable, and his hair is like ridiculous, like lion's mane of curly hair in that movie
I
too.
mean, it was like, he's got that whole feral lion thing going on in that first Mad Max movie. And on a more shallow note, Fury Road is also where I was introduced to Riley Keough, who is both one of my favorite actors currently working and at this point, one of my longest running actor crushes.
Oh yeah, she's great. Speaking of troubled people, she's in probably my favorite sequence in the house that Jack built, which Lars purposely backs like an asshole because that's kind of his sense of humor. He's mainly on purpose, but I do love that movie for the most part, and her segment is really striking, and she actually is given like this is a really interesting thing to do.
A smaller film she did a few years back. Oh God, I have to look up the name, but it was a romance that she did with Jenna Malone. Scroll, scroll, scroll. Love Song, which is a really interesting meditation on the way time shapes us, especially in terms of our relationships with other people. Estrangement by distance, not by malice or any falling out, just by living different lives. While they both deeply love each other, it may not be the love. It wasn't what it is not the love it what they first had. It's not the love they could have had.
But Free Fear is this perfect mix of like it's a legit, like real movie with themes, and it's trying to say something. It's also a badass action movie. It managed to strike that balance in a way that I feel a lot of movies can't really, or try to and fail. Like, kind of like
Cough the Revenant, cough.
Like, it's kind of high praise, but like, it kind of feels like Seven Samurai in that way of like, it's this popcorn movie, but there's so much more going on within the movie. And you can see it as a purely a popcorn movie, or you can look deeper into it and you see exactly successfully trying to say something and like be, as Scorsese would say, like, real cinema. Joel, I believe he has some problems with the movie.
What movie would that be?
You're out.
Oh, no, I was just joking.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't seen it since. I literally have not seen it since the theater, which I saw it twice in. And, another great podcast, the Losers podcast, Wendy Mays and Shay. Oh man, I forgot her last name. Anyways, Shay apparently hates that movie. I'd be interested to know why that. So I'm like, there's a part of my eye that wants to go back and watch this and think about like the larger context of the time we live in now of scenes and stuff like that. Like I could pick apart things like the whole desert shower scene, which is kind of weird. But I mean, I do love the movie, so.
I mean, it's a crazy fantasy world. I think it's easy to excuse something like that. All right, and I think that might be the only crossover with all of us. So, Justin, do you have like one or two?
Just the one, that being Michael Mann's often maligned Black Hat from the start of 2015, which was, until Fury Road, my favorite film of 2015. It is certainly a film with its fair share of issues, particularly given that the version I am most familiar with was hastily re-edited at the last minute to move a significant incident from midway through the film to to make it the inciting incident. But it is one of the very, very few films I have seen to engage with the dehumanization of our increasingly digital world in a way that doesn't feel thoughtlessly technophobic or perhaps Pollyanna-ish. Like the other thing that comes to mind is Daniel Goldhaber and Issa Mae's horror picture Cam from last year. There, it has a truly frightening villain played by Yorick Van Wangen. It's cool to see Chris Hemsworth, playing a Michael Mann archetype. One of the script's weaknesses is that it does have some kind of overly fanservice-y nods to past characters and such. Yeah, Yorick van Wageningen, Wageningen. Yorick van Wageningen, who was also in The Chronicles of Riddick in a brief but memorable part. It is a really striking contrast not only to Hemsworth, who is motivated even in this group, which is fairly tense because you have a Chinese cop, his civilian sister, an American FBI agent, a U.S. marshal, and a convicted felon, all of them working together to try and seek out this mysterious ne'er-do-well to death, to murder, both in a world that is increasingly depersonalized and to the weight of such an action. And, on a purely aesthetic level, Chris Hemsworth fucking shanks a dude with a screwdriver. It's hard to top that. So, very much not a film for everyone. I adore it.
And
True.
yeah, Joel, what do you have other 2015?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Okay, so if I had to pick something, like, because I think I saw a lot of good things in 2015, apparently, or from 2015. Let me narrow it down here. There's a couple of things we covered on Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space, my science fiction and fantasy podcast. There is Turbo Kid, which is a very gory but also a lot of fun post-apocalyptic movie. Same here as Mad Max Fury Road, but it's not Well, Mad Max feels like an epic. Turbo Kid is kind of a smaller story. It feels more like one of the previous movies, but it could take place in the same world almost. And I highly recommend that. Let's see. Also, oof, The Boy Next Door came out that year. So not everything was good.
Long way from Hustlers.
No, huh?
Oh,
Same person?
yeah.
No.
Same
Oh,
star,
Jennifer
but
Lopez. I mean, she's got all kinds of directions when it comes to her roles, so shades of blue. Let's see. Bone Tomahawk? I don't know how I feel about S. Craig Zahler's political ideologies because I don't know the man himself. Some of it seems a little iffy, but Bone Tomahawk is a supremely well-made movie. And it's one of the Kurt Russell movies where he came back from whatever ditch he was living in with Goldie Hawn to come back into our lives and bring us so much joy again.
The
Yeah,
way
and then
you
the
said it,
opening.
I'm just picturing like it must be a super nice
Oh
ditch.
yeah, no, don't get me wrong. Like
Yeah,
they've just carved out a couch or something.
and then the opening scene of Bone Tomahawk. Do you know who gets killed?
Oh, I don't remember.
And Mr. Sid Haig, rest in peace.
Oh, okay.
Oh man.
That's
Yeah.
he's the reason I watched that movie.
I've seen Bone Tomahawk and enjoyed it a lot. I've seen part of Brawl, which Spencer, I think you thought very highly of.
I love Brawl. I don't mind that over 2 hours.
And I liked Dragged Across Concrete as a movie. I'm not sure I can really recommend it to anyone in good conscience without a whole bunch of fucking caveats.
Right.
Um,
Well, yeah, Mel Gibson is a hard pass for me.
yeah,
Yeah, that's entirely reasonable.
Yeah, he's not just an asshole, he's a racist. That makes it much worse for me.
Yeah, it's like at this point, if I were to ever meet S. Craig Zahler, we'd either get along really well or turn into a fist fight, or
He
possibly both.
likes metal, so we could talk about metal bands.
If there is one thing I can unambiguously recommend from Dragged, it's the soundtrack where Zahler and his music writing partner wrote a whole bunch of lyrics and commissioned a whole bunch of classic soul bands to do them, just like they did for Brawl. But the music's a lot more extensive and it's really good. Problematic fave.
And I mean that's okay. I still think yeah, you make some good movies.
Like someone being conservative or like your opposite political opinion is one thing, but when you add like racism or a long history of assaults, that kind of makes it different.
I see, the only time I take a real issue with somebody being a conservative that's a filmmaker is when they have jumped on the calling people libtards, calling people social justice warriors train, which is why fuck Eli Roth. I don't like his movies anyways. Crimson Peak is one of my favorites.
Underappreciated.
Guillermo del Toro, yeah, I think it's such a beautiful movie, and it is plenty violent, like the stuff that he used to do, and it's got great performances.
Things go into people's faces that should never, ever, ever go into people's
Oh
faces, but more is there to say.
yeah, I think that Mia Wasikowska is probably in my top 10 of actresses right now. Like I just get excited when I see that she's in a movie. And
It's no, I was the one interrupting you, my bad.
no, that's fine. I was just gonna say the last one I'll mention is Green Room, which is a movie that
Oh,
I,
fuck
yeah,
yes.
once again, I probably will never watch Green Room again because it's a little too intense for me, but
Yeah, that's on my list too.
I mean, I count
Like
that as a 2016 film, but
Right.
like I
It's just
my tattoo is from Green Room,
Oh, there you go.
so
Yeah, Green Room was like I was one of two people in the theater, and at a certain scene involving a hand,
Yes.
I heard a very loud "Oh!" when it happened, and it was not me, the other person. I was laughing.
You get a feeling in the pit of your stomach. Just,
Oh, I
yeah.
got that too, but like having hearing someone's reaction was just like
Yeah.
the only way I could deal with it. But Green
Yeah.
Room was so fucking good.
One
I
of
have not
the.
watched it.
I really wish Anton Yelchin was still
Yes, that's what I
alive.
was going to say. One of the many movies that just shows what a loss that was and how screwed up, how screwed up it can
Like,
be.
like if I chuck Jared Kushner into a volcano, can I have Yelchin back?
No, we're gonna give a couple of actors. So let's stick with the Jared. We'll do Jared Leto. Let's see who
I
else.
mean, like he's pushing 40, so we could get two young people for him.
That's true. Yeah, I have
Yeah.
not seen it since the theater because after Anton Yelchin died, I was like, I can't watch anything with him in it.
Yeah, I got those
And
Star
he
Trek
was.
movies, and I just can't.
And there's a couple movies he'd made earlier on that I loved in high school. I just can't rewatch.
I've rewatched it a few times since his death. I think it happened like when we had it running at the Alamo. So, but I showed it to my dad. I showed it to my best friend, who, bless him, is still my best friend despite my tendency to show them the most bleak and disturbing stuff I can find.
Oh, show the Transfiguration. It's a great vampire movie.
I've heard I
That's.
there's a film critic I like named his internet handle is Vice Victus. He spoke really highly of that.
I fucking love that movie. I don't know if I want an episode on it. It might be just too grim. I don't know if people would if you would want to sit through it. It's a lot to take in, but it's a great black horror movie.
Yeah, it's definitely on my list. Although, granted, my best friend also. Their response to our seeing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is "Let's watch Perfect Blue." So we have had our share of showing each other traumatic movies.
I think Green Room was the only other crossover. Anyway, Joel, was that it for you?
I mean, that's enough, I think.
Okay. And quick mention, The Dressmaker. I think it's an Australian movie. And it's basically like taking like a classic Western format, but it's Kate Winslet going back to her old town and she makes dresses for women. And it's like using like her making dresses as like a metaphor of like her being the sheriff, like gunning down bad people. It's a really interesting twist on the Western.
She's gunning down bad people with dresses.
It's all metaphorical. It's
I
just a really
had no interest in this movie, and now it is in my watch list with your description.
it's a Western. It's just like in her instead of shooting bullets, she makes dresses, and it's just a really cool take on the genre. And The Gift, which I think people don't like in general,
Gordo.
but I really enjoyed it. It's like a fun thriller. It's it could have gone down, could have taken a really obvious stupid choices at one point, but it doesn't. It's smart enough to know not to go down a generic path for the type of movie it is, but it's a fun movie that gets a little dark, but it's I think it shouldn't be forgotten. And in the lore, the mermaid murder musical thing from Poland, which is on Criterion, and it's if you like weirdo shit, yeah, I highly recommend it. And it's basically a retelling of The Little Mermaid in very broad strokes, but set in 80s-ish Poland. And there's a lot of like weird sexual humor that makes sense. I think makes sense in a Polish setting, but outside of Poland, just comes off as strange. It's still really funny, and there's a great soundtrack. In The Witch, but everyone talks about The Witch, so.
I suppose that reminds me of the film of 2015 also gave us Rick Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, which is a movie from a world where jocks aren't dreadful people, he said, making a broad stereotypical generalization. But it's a really neat study of time and a perception of it as well as the pursuit of passion. In the case of most of our leads, baseball. In the case of Zoe Deutsch, who plays the female lead, it's theater. The intersections between and the intersection between the time available to us and what it is that we strive for. Plus, you got like Taylor Hoechlin running around in very little clothing. There's beefcake aplenty.
Coming up is the Old Boy pairing, which we're going to talk about the original Old Boy and the Spike Lee remake.
I've seen the original. I have not seen Lee's. I understand he's very unhappy with how it turned out.
Lot of people aren't happy with how it turned out.
I'm excited.
It might be. I like it less than She Hate Me. Because She Hate Me, at least the train wreck, that's fun to watch. And
You showed me those. You showed me the Anthony Mackie spoof scenes. I curse you.
It's
Like it
ridiculous.
less than She Hate Me.
I think so.
Whoa. I'm no longer excited.
You might like it, but I personally think it's his worst movie
I mean,
by a
ever
long
since we
shot.
watched frickin' with the Gajah and Hess remake one, and I really liked that one. I don't know what I'm gonna like and not like anymore.
Yeah, I might like it this time, but the first time I watched it, I hated it. Oh wait, no, Red Hook Summer is also pretty bad after halfway point. But anyway, it'll be the Old Boy pairing with Chameleon Street will be the special episode for the month. That'll be hopefully M2MA and Marcus Penn will be on that one because I know they're super fans of Chameleon Street and that movie doesn't get enough love. And if you want to try to find it, well, good luck. If you know someone who has the file or hat or willing to spend $8 on a DVD, then go for it. But besides that, it's hard to find. And that's it. So, Justin, I believe you write for a couple sites.
Yeah, you can find most of my work at Birth Movies Death, and occasionally I pop up at Clint Worthington's The Spool. When is this episode going to drop?
This will end end of November.
All right, well, but I've got some stuff that's coming out now, but at that point, you should still be able to order the Birth Movies Death Collector's issue of. For Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. I've got two essays in there, one on Forrest Whitaker's character, Saw Gerrera, who is kind of fascinating in Star Wars lore as being both a explicitly a heroic character and one of the most ruthless and brutal protagonists in what is a fairly black and white moral series. And a piece on Luke Skywalker's transformation from lonely farm boy to bitter old wizard.
Yeah, the note of the Saw Gerrera character, it's clearly based off of she. I always say his last name wrong.
Guevara.
Yeah, and my grandma's cousin worked in Cuba during before the revolution and would see him on a regular basis. And
Huh.
apparently, he was nice to my grandma's cousin. But then he left Cuba once the violence started, and he realized, oh, that guy was dangerous.
Yep.
There's another by the time this comes out, we'll have an episode on the movie Yesterday from this year. That we had Jacob Holler from the Love Ya Like Crazy podcast.
I cut the part out. And yeah, so the Old Boys, and yeah, that's coming after us. And thank you for listening. And drop this movie if you haven't seen Spotlight. It's upsetting, but
Well worth it.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found that. Podbean.com and Spotify and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.